Good afternoon. This is Mae Bressel in Carmel, California. It's May the 9th, 1977. Got the year straight. Dialogue conspiracy number 268. I suppose it's timely to talk about Watergate for the next week or two because of the Richard Nixon interviews with David Frost on television. I watched the program, of course. I have my own personal feelings about the whole spectacle. In the first place, I find it very disgusting. I don't think that Richard Nixon is particularly a sympathetic character to feel sorry for, but I don't like to see his face tortured on television. He wants to get his place in history back. He's willing to stand before the American people and be grilled on certain questions, and they were pretty easy questions. And he needs the money to pay various lawsuits. They run into the millions, so as much as he gets will be put out again. But I don't like to see a man who we know is guilty being told to say he was guilty on the television, which he's not going to say. Either he's so programmed or he never believed that he was guilty, and I don't like to see any point in pressuring him to say something that isn't going to be said anyway and then watching him squirm. It's typical of the American capitalistic society of making money. David Frost made millions, and Richard Nixon will make millions. There's a lot of good commercials going in talk shows, and I find the whole thing disgusting. Richard Nixon's purposeful is to alleviate the national guilt. He is the one we point to. We think of World War II. We point to Adolf Hitler. We think of the era of the Cold War and the Watergate scandals that were massive, and we say Richard Nixon. And it's a catharsis, and it's also a diversionary. There's a lot of things going on in the news that I would like to see discussed at length, and they're not being discussed. I have maybe several hundred articles of importance, and I think are 10 times more valuable than rehashing what Richard Nixon said on the screen, but they never get into the headlines, and so it's a diversion. One example is an article just last week. It was April 28th, New York Times, about General Motors, that they were being held for a tax fraud inquiry by the IRS. The grand jury's been investigating illegal conduit of money and income tax returns, falsifying income tax returns at the General Motors, and they stalled the hearings to begin again on May the 16th. This is April 28th in the New York Times. And then May the 3rd, just a few days later, 5 days later, the former president of General Motors was killed in a plane crash, Edward N. Cole. And the way I read the news is to save certain articles that look large and involve clandestine money that's being passed, a perversion of the Internal Revenue Service, the collusion of the courts, and you take these large tax fraud cases against the corporations and criminal investigations, and pretty soon, within 1 to 3 weeks, the major witnesses are dead. It'll be interesting to see what role Edward N. Cole plays in the tax fraud inquiry now that he's dead, because the hearings, as I say, are going to take place May the 16th. But when the former president of General Motors gets a 2 to 3 inch notice in the newspapers, a wire service story that he simply died in a plane crash, it's interesting to me because it seems to me that he would have gotten a lot more attention. So I'm wondering if there's any relationship to his plane crash to the tax inquiry, and if there was or wasn't, there's been no article making connections and not much on the news about this death. There also is another article in Nation magazine this week. It was February 77 that a fellow researcher sent to me from Pennsylvania that interests me and should, I think, concern the people in this country about the Veterans Administration building new cemeteries. Arlington National Cemetery, this article states, is a nice place to visit, but would 60 million people want to lie there, or 160 million others pay the bill? This article goes on to say that there's now a proposal for 5 new national cemeteries, each one the size of Arlington, each costing 24 to 30 million, and a constituency of 30 million American veterans and their kin. And the plans are for the government to bury 1/4 of the American population, approximately 63 million people. Now, this was in Nation magazine, February 1977, and this concerns an area that I've been watching called the energy crisis, because a gentleman who I've quoted many times on Dialogue Conspiracy went to England a few years ago, left and told me about the studies at RAND and the think tanks to create a false energy crisis that would eliminate 63 million Americans, 63 million Americans, this study. And then, in quotes, the energy crisis would be over because they wouldn't be draining the heat and the water and the resources. So I think it's very interesting that the government is now planning the burial for 60 million American people and has five sites. The places of burial for one quarter of the population of the United States are in Massachusetts, Indiantown, Gap, Pennsylvania, a third in Riverside, California, two sites at Quantico, Virginia, and one at Calverton, New York. So if you are planning to move, I suggest that you don't choose these five locations as a place to live, because I still believe that we are going to have a so-called terrorist killing. It won't be terrorists. It will be counterintelligence of chemicals thrown over a particular city to sacrifice it. And there will be mass burials in this country in a short time in order to alleviate a large mass of the population. That sounds scary. I do have this document or statement of this particular person who did leave the country of 63 million, and so I think it's interesting to read right now in Nation magazine that the country is providing $1 million, 30 million each for five cemeteries to bury one quarter of the population of the United States. That goes along with that hospital for radiation at Travis Air Force Base I've been talking about for several years. Most expensive hospital in America that's on a secret Army Air Force base in California. But these are the kind of things that don't get disseminated over the news, and yet there's all this talk show on whether Richard Nixon sweats or doesn't sweat, or his body talk, and trivia about Richard Nixon. Also, I think that the only important thing that Richard Nixon said in the entire 90-minute interview was hardly repeated in the headlines. It got no coverage at all. And this is when Nixon said, "Some allies were telling me that there was a conspiracy to get you." This is what they said to Richard Nixon, "There's a conspiracy to get you." And Nixon said, "That may be the case," hinting of shenanigans by the Central Intelligence Agency that have yet to surface. Now, we know the CIA isn't supposed to work domestically. We know the CIA isn't supposed to be involved in the assassination of John Kennedy or Robert Kennedy or Martin Luther King, or be up at Chappaquiddick the night that Ted Kennedy had the accident. Mary Jo Kopechne is dead. And the same way, interfering with the shooting of George Wallace down in Maryland when he was paralyzed and couldn't run for president. But here's a man who won the election in 1972, who is telling the people on the American screen that the CIA could have been up to shenanigans that have not yet been surfaced, that were out to get him. He rejected the idea that there was a complete coup, but he left it open that the CIA could have gotten him out of office. The same evening that Richard Nixon was on the program nationwide, a radio show in Los Angeles, Ray Bream, KABC, late in the evening, had Frank Sturgis as an interview. He was talking with Ray Bream on the air that same night, I guess talking about Richard Nixon, and Frank Sturgis had called a press conference in Texas. Frank Sturgis used to go by the name of Frank Fiorini. He was an agent of the CIA. He's one of the men arrested at the Watergate Hotel in June 1972. Now, what did Frank Sturgis say? I don't have a complete tape of his conversation, but I called Ray Bream the next day when I heard about it and confirmed. And here are a few sentences of what Frank Sturgis is saying in 1977. He said that Richard Nixon was framed by the CIA, and this is a man that was involved in the Watergate. He said the bungling of the Watergate operation was a conspiracy to remove Richard Nixon out of office and embarrass him, which would mean then that Vice President Spiro Agnew would become the President of the United States. He said Nixon was going too far in recognizing Russia and China. Frank Sturgis said that as soon as Nixon realized what was happening at Watergate, when the men were arrested, he called Richard Helms, who was then the director of the CIA, and asked for the complete file on the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And then Richard Helms disobeyed him. He disobeyed the presidential orders and would not turn over to Richard Nixon the CIA files on the John Kennedy assassination. He also said the CIA had the choice of either killing Richard Nixon or slipping him out of office, so they used the White House bugging system to get him out of office and be discredited. That reminds me, and I've mentioned to you before, that the minute the men were arrested at the Watergate Hotel, the next morning I called Bernard Fensterwald, who was James McCord's lawyer in the whole Watergate matter, on June the 18th, and said they caught the boys involved in the Kennedy assassination last night at the Watergate Hotel, that the web or the net caught them, and they were arrested. I also said that the script for Watergate was that Richard Nixon, I published this in one of my first articles, Richard Nixon discovered that they were out to get him, embarrass him by what was the Watergate fiasco. And as soon as he found that out, he isolated Spiro Agnew and sent him to California, which I called the Siberia of the Washington establishment, and sent him out there and never saw him again or allowed him in the White House except once when Agnew called and asked the protocol if he could be invited for dinner. And he was kicked out to Palm Springs. Then Agnew was taken out of office as vice president quickly, so that in case Nixon did die while still in office, Agnew wouldn't be president. And I called that Nixon's vengeance, because as soon as they were arrested, he realized that the people that wanted Spiro Agnew were getting him out of office one way or the other. And if he was going out, he would take Agnew down first. And then after Agnew was out, he appointed Gerald Ford as vice president, who had been his selection on the John Kennedy assassination, to cover up the traces going back to the Kennedy assassination of the whole team that were in office at the time. My early article in The Realist goes into the points that Frank Sturgis has confirmed, and I wrote that 5 years ago. He also said that the offices of Robert Mullen and Company, where Robert Bennett ran the offices, were the source of the plans to remove Richard Nixon from office. This is from Frank Sturgis on Ray Bream's show, KABC in Los Angeles. After I called Ray Thursday night, he had Sturgis on for 2 more hours to confirm and repeat the same conversation, and various researchers tape-recorded the show for me. Now, in August 72, when I first came up with my first article, Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped?, and had a press conference in Los Angeles, there were certain things that I wrote in that article that confirm what Frank Sturgis is saying now, and I might just read about 5 sentences from that article to refresh your memory, because it was 5 years ago. And if you don't have any copies of this article or my article, the Senate Select Committee is part of the cover-up, you can write to me, and I will mail them to you. They're $1 each and send a self-addressed stamped envelope. I wrote in 1972 that all men caught in the Democratic headquarters were connected with the CIA. They had all worked together since the Bay of Pigs operation. That Frank Sturgis, this is the gentleman speaking up now, was a close friend of Diaz Lanz, a Cuban exile, and that he was connected with the farthest right-wing movements, the John Birch Society, Billy James Hargis, Christian Crusade, and that's the group now that is sponsoring Spiro Agnew's books and publications that he is working with. I had linked Sturgis with that group, which is Agnew's group at that time. I said Sturgis was among those questioned by the FBI after the Kennedy assassination. His home had been an arsenal with 20-millimeter cannons, and Carlos Prio Siqueiros, former president of Cuba, was planning demonstrations for the Miami conventions, as was Frank Sturgis. Siqueiros was shot down outside of his home or in the garage early in the morning, just about a month ago, in Florida, and he would be an important witness to the congressional investigations into the Kennedy assassination. I wrote about the offices of Robert Bennett, who Mullen and Company, that worked closely with the CIA, and they worked with Douglas Caddy, who shared an office with E. Howard Hunt in this particular Mullen and Company. Caddy, I wrote, was co-founder of Young American for Freedom, and Robert Mullen was alleged to be a CIA front and worked with Douglas Caddy. The office was run by Robert Bennett, who then left the Watergate investigations totally untarnished and came out to be chief of public relations for Summa Corporation. Robert Mullen's offices not only was a CIA front, but the co-founders of the Young Americans for Freedom, the group that are still supporting Spiro Agnew's funding and his trips and his foundation, they work closely with Agnew today, were all at the Bennett office. And what Frank Sturgis was saying, the plans to remove Richard Nixon came out of the Robert Bennett offices, Mullen and Company, and they were closely working with Richard Nixon's vice president, Spiro Agnew. I wrote at the time 5 years ago that President Richard Nixon was receiving secretly funds up to $10 million that went in to the Mullen office and that the funds would have been cut off in 1968 if he did not take Spiro Agnew as his vice president. That was one of the conditions, that he had to take Spiro Agnew as a vice president. I wrote about Tom Pappas, the conduit of money, and this comes out in the newly revealed Watergate tapes, that this was a source of money, and that he was the one who was anxious to have Agnew as president. He also was a source of a payoff of the various people that got caught who had made plans for the Watergate fiasco that came out of the Mullen office. Tom Pappas was funding money for their legal funds and payoffs and keeping them quiet and very happy. And I asked about Douglas Caddy, the co-founder of Young Americans for Freedom, because the role that they played in the Kennedy assassination in Dallas, Texas in 1963, and the release of those people's names linked to Watergate now, like William Buckley and E. Howard Hunt, helping to form the YAF, and Douglas Caddy, all working closely with this office of Mullen Associates. This is important because Frank Sturgis is telling you there was a group that came out of that office that tried to get Richard Nixon out of the presidency. And I was asking the question back 5 years ago about this particular office. I think the Sturgis statement this time is important because he knows that his co-workers are being killed, the witnesses to the Kennedy assassination are being killed, and that he wants a certain security, and I'm sure that he is offering to tell more if they touch him. And that's why he's giving the interviews at this time about Nixon asking for the Kennedy file. In 1973, which was 4 years ago, I wrote in my article in The Realist, the Senate Select Committee is part of the cover-up, about the use of book publishers as a CIA way of silencing money, that Martha Mitchell was told she would get $2 million for a book, just like Marina Oswald was offered $125,000 cash to write a book that was never published. And E. Howard Hunt was writing a book, and I wrote that this is a typical clandestine message in seeking a bribe or a payoff. It doesn't have to be a bestseller, but it introduces you to a lot of people, and book money is a way of respectability of paying people who've been part of an operation instead of just handing them a check. So for a little while, I want to read to you some of the payoffs of people involved in Watergate, including books and lectures. I sent off an article to Midnight that has some of these people in it. They didn't have space for all of them, but they're the Watergate payoffs, and I thought I would give you some of these that are not in the article, and some will be. Remember that Joseph Kraft, who has worked closely with the establishment news media all these years, just wrote after the Nixon-Frost conversations the other day, not debates, he said, there remains the major question of why the Watergate break-in occurred, what information is being sought, and on whose behalf. Frank Sturgis said it was done to get Nixon out of office, therefore Agnew would have benefited, and the bungling was done on purpose. Joseph Kraft says why and what and who gained, and he said as long as these questions abide, some hardworking and tenacious journalists will be pushing to learn more. Well, I believe that the payoff of books and lectures for many, many people involved directly in the Watergate or in the investigation of it is very heavy and into the many millions for, I think, eight reasons. And these are the areas that they haven't covered, haven't written about. You've read many books on Watergate. There's been a Pulitzer Prize for Woodward and Bernstein. And you go to bookstores and libraries and books to come, but not one of those books yet, and I guess they run into 40 or 50 books so far, not one of them mentions heavily the links of Howard Hughes to the CIA other than the Glomar Explorer, and the links to Watergate of Mr. Bennett and the Hughes Organization and Larry O'Brien. Never heavily into the Hughes part that was never asked by any of the prosecutors. They never went into the Wallace shooting or even suggested that George Wallace was shot by these people. They haven't gone into the J. Edgar Hoover murder, even though there's hard evidence that there was a conspiracy to murder J. Edgar Hoover and silence him and get him out of the way. Andrew Tully once wrote that Richard Nixon was in trouble because he was surrounded by the same CIA that J. Edgar Hoover feared. And Hoover had said he needed me to protect him from these people around him. This is what J. Edgar Hoover said in January 1972. Richard Nixon needed me to protect them, and in May 1972, Hoover was dead, and the CIA was out to remove Nixon to get Agnew into office. They never went into the murder of Mary Jo Kopechne, even though Herbert Kalmbach had paid Tony Laswitz $100,000 in June, and he was at Chappaquiddick in July at the time Mary Jo was dead. The committees, the prosecutors never went into the Dorothy Hunt plane crash, even though she's very important in the payoff and silencing and as a CIA conduit for many, many years. Nor did they investigate what Martha Mitchell knew, even though the new tapes mentioned her name and mentioned Dorothy Hunt's name. They never went into that. They never investigated the potential for Miami riots or sought to compare them to the riots in Chicago that were caused in 1968. And they never went into the plans to kill Richard Nixon, even though they had arrested Andrew Topping and Lewis Tackwood, had the San Diego Army documentations. The payoffs for the various rioters and so forth are because they have not handled these eight areas. The Hughes area, the Wallace shooting, the killing of J. Edgar Hoover, the murder of Mary Jo Kopechne, the murder of Dorothy Hunt, which includes 45 people with her, the killing, the injection, and the silencing of Martha Mitchell, the planned riots in Miami, and the plans to kill Richard Nixon. Of course, the losers of all of this were many, many people, at least 40 witnesses that have been dead since Watergate, and that's just 5 years ago. The big winner of the story was Gerald Ford, number one, because he obstructed investigation of the Wright-Patman Committee and the Watergate tapes. They said, let's call in Jerry, and he stopped the investigation. He told the congressman not to go the day that they were meeting or voting, and in exchange, he became the vice president and the president of the United States, and now he has a contract. He has an agency, I believe it's Music Corporation of America. Jerry Ford has a $1 million book coming out, and Betty Ford has a $1 million book. That was their payoff. William Colby, the director of the CIA, wrote to Senator Howard Baker in June 28, 74, a memorandum in which he said that Sam Ervin was controlled by the CIA, that Robert Bennett from Mullen Associates could handle Sam Ervin, and the CIA could handle E. Howard Hunt. The rewards for Mr. Bennett giving information and handling Sam Ervin and for giving information to Bob Woodward was that Robert Bennett went on to become chief of security for Summa Corporation, owned by Howard Hughes in California. And Robert and Bob Woodward, who was the recipient of the CIA information that got Nixon out of office, made $1 million on All the President's Men as a book. He made $1 million on it as a movie. He wrote another book, The Final Days, and All Rights, adds up to many $1 million in exchange for the CIA agent, Hughes agent Bennett, telling enough on Nixon to get him out of office without implicating these eight other areas I talked about. Senator Howard Baker, who closed the Watergate hearings by saying we've seen the tip of the iceberg, came out the strongest Republican leader outside of Ronald Reagan. Howard Baker was part of the Senate cover-up. The Washington Post revealed this week a conversation about Howard Baker in a Colson-Nixon conversation March 21st. Colson said he received a call from an aide of Senator Baker's, the ranking minority member of the Senate. According to Charles Colson, the aide wanted advice on Baker's behalf on how he could help Richard Nixon while his investigation was going on. What Howard really wants to do is work with us totally, Charles Colson said. Don't pay any attention to what he's been saying publicly. This is in the White House tapes. That's a man that you may have as your president someday. The darling of the news media, Howard Baker, sends an aide to say, while I'm up front telling the people in the media one thing, don't pay any attention. I want to help Richard Nixon. Colson described Baker's fear that his secret consultations while he was investigating the Watergate with Attorney General Richard Kleindienst during the Senate Watergate investigation might be discovered and blow his cover. Colson also congratulated an aide to Howard Baker confided at one point that Baker wanted to be able to keep at bay and to keep control of the Watergate chairman, Sam Ervin. And Senator Howard Baker's reward has become the darling of the Senate and probably the most powerful Republican out in the House right now. Gerald Terhorst, the public relations man that managed Gerald Ford, has come out with a book. He has a publisher. It's called Gerald Ford and the Future of the Presidency. Gail Magruder, the wife of defendant Jeb Magruder, who is deep in Watergate crime, got a book publisher. She wrote A Gift of Love. I didn't figure these out in terms of dollars and cents, but you might add it up if you want. John Ehrlichman, has been selling his paintings. He's spending a short time in jail right now. It isn't the hardest jail. He has movie rights coming up, and he got a book called The Company. Jeb Magruder wrote a book, An American Life, One Man's Road to Watergate, and was hired immediately by Young Life. Dwight Chapin, the appointment secretary, was deeply involved in Watergate, had all of his jail time paid for by Clement Stone in Chicago, Illinois, and is now working for Clement Stone or United Airlines. He got a job back that was waiting for him with no trouble as soon as he was out, and he was paid salary while he was in. Fred Thompson, the special prosecutor who kept us from knowing the whole truth, wrote a book at that point in time, The Inside Story of the Senate Watergate Committee. James McCord was giving lectures on the campus. He wrote a book called A Piece of Tape, The True Story of the Wiretaps. Henry Kissinger signed a 5-year contract with NBC for several million dollars. He has a book with an advance from $2 to $3 million. He is now a consultant for Chase Manhattan Bank, even though he was heavily involved in wiretaps from 1969 to 1971 and knew they were illegal. Robert Haldeman is ready to sign a deal. He's been offered $80,000 to make ad spots for commercials for a tape recording company. James Hamilton, an assistant chief counsel of the Watergate Committee, wrote the book The Power to Probe, A Study of a Congressional Investigation. Someday I'll write my story on the Watergate and show how they were all paid off to keep from you all the facts of these 8 major stories that I listed before. Charles Bates of the FBI was the FBI agent in charge of handling the Watergate investigations under Patrick Gray, who was busy destroying important evidence as the acting director of the FBI. Charles Bates left Washington, D.C., and because of the dismal failure of the FBI to investigate the Watergate case, he was sent to San Francisco and promoted to the chief of the FBI just in time for the Patty Hearst kidnapping. In James McCord's book, Piece of Tape, he writes that Patrick Gray informed John Dean that Charles Bates of the FBI was handling the Watergate investigation. In the June 23rd tape of 1972, there's a conversation of Richard Nixon, and the jurors heard Mr. Nixon give an order to limit the Federal and Bureau of Investigation inquiry into the break-in and do so with no more apparent concern than a small-town mayor might show ordering a parking ticket fixed for a friend. He said to them, don't lie to them to the extent to say there's no involvement, but just say this is a comedy of errors, and we wish for the country that they don't go any further into the case. That's Charles Bates, who had a role. He was in Chicago at the time of the killing of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, that COINTELPRO operation. And in 1972, Black Abductor, the script for the Patty Hearst kidnapping, was published in San Diego, ready for the 74 kidnapping of Patty. It was done by a pornographic, non-existent book publisher or author. And at that time, Robert Mayhew was doing pornographic books for the CIA under the cover of Views, making one on President Sukarno. And out of this non-existent firm and author comes a script for the Patty Hearst kidnapping. So Charles Bates couldn't be fired. He had to be promoted. And he goes on to Washington, from Washington, D.C., and the FBI out to San Francisco. Nixon's resignation, June 23rd, 1972, 6 days after the burglary, where they planned to get the CIA to persuade the officials of the FBI not to go too deeply, involved Charles Bates, who then goes to San Francisco for his important job. Richard Benvenisti, one of the prosecutors of the Watergate, wrote a book which will be out soon called Stonewall, The Real Story of the Watergate Prosecution. How many real stories can they have without Dorothy Hunt, Martha Mitchell, the riot, the Hughes, the Wallace shooting, the Mary Jo Kopechne murder, J. Hoover death? How many can they write? But here's one, The Real Story of the Watergate. In this book, Benvenisti says that Leon Jaworski wanted to get out so fast and get back to Houston, Texas, and that he may have met privately with Gerald Ford and encouraged them to pardon Richard Nixon. If you read a transcript of the tapes, which I'll read to you next week if I don't have time this week, it was Charles Colson's idea to bring in a special prosecutor who was on their side, who would cover for them, who would have prestige. One of the people he suggested, Nixon suggested, was J. Lee Rankin, who was the chief attorney for the Warren Commission. But instead, they brought in Leon Jaworski, who was the attorney for the CIA on the Warren Commission to represent the state of Texas. And according to Benvenisti, all he wanted to do was get home. Archibald Cox, who wasn't doing a good job but turned out looking like a hero, is now teaching law at Harvard. And while he was special prosecutor, nothing came out along these other lines. Of course, the four Cubans known as Bernard Barker, Eugene Martinez, Virgilio Gonzalez, and Frank Sturgis, each got $50,000 cash just recently, but I'm sure they were given a salary the entire time that they were in jail. That's just a start, a $200,000 settlement for those men, which would cover, say, the year that they were in jail. Maureen Dean, the wife of John Dean, got a book published called Mo. It's being promoted back east and around the country. Just recently, the social section of the Washington Post said that Mrs. Barry Goldwater had a luncheon promoting her book for her in Washington, D.C. That's Maureen Dean's Mo. Seymour Glanzer, one of the three Watergate prosecutors, the assistant under U.S. Attorney General Peterson, left the Justice Department after his bad prosecution and joined the law firm of Dickstein, Shapiro, and Morin. This is the firm that defended Spiro Agnew in the Watergate case and also former White House Special Counsel Charles Colson. So that instead of prosecuting further the involvement of Agnew and Colson in illegal funding and crime, Glanzer did a bad job and now works with the law firm that took care of these men. In the same way that Henry Peterson, who was the head of the Justice Department investigation, did such a bad job of finding any fault with John Mitchell that he was appointed to the law firm of John Mitchell's lawyer, William Hundley, who was the attorney for Mitchell during the Watergate affair. He joined that law firm recently. Peterson was criticized on the White House tapes. They revealed that he handed to Richard Nixon private grand jury reports. His men testified the grand jury. He gave them to Richard Nixon, and he was responsible for the three assistant U.S. attorneys. Peterson is also mentioned, and this is scandalous, in the April 26th meeting in 1973. And Richard Nixon said, I'm in a totally defensible position with what I'm doing. Robert Haldeman said, you are if Peterson holds up. He's going to hold up, I think, Nixon said. It depends on how much Dean has on him, and he has a lot, Haldeman said. I know, Nixon agreed. And Peterson may be just as worried at his level about what Dean's got at him as you are on what he may have on you, Haldeman said. Peterson, I think, is going to hold up on that point, Nixon said. Our lawyers, John Wilson and Frank Strickler, lawyers for Haldeman and Ehrlichman, don't even agree with him as a counsel. Our lawyers totally distrust Peterson, Haldeman said. Yeah, I know, said Nixon. They distrust him. But he's all I got, Bob. And I think, though, that Peterson on the other level. Other hand, I had repeated that so often to him, I never failed to unintelligible. We'll just say, we've got that taped, Henry. And that's how Richard Nixon got a weak prosecution out of Henry Peterson. He says he's going to hold up because Dean has things on him, and Peterson may be as worried at his level of what John Dean has on him as you are on what he has on you. And that's the way they run the halls of justice in Washington, D.C. The special prosecutor then goes on, by not prosecuting John Mitchell or involving him, he becomes a law partner in the office of John Mitchell. E. Howard Hunt is out. He has nationwide tours. He has a book called Undercover, Memoirs of an American Secret Agent. He also, like John Ehrlichman, is selling his watercolors. Robert Mardian has now got his law degree reinstated. He has permission to resume his legal career. No investigation is going into his plans to round up radicals, to kidnap American youth in Florida, to take them to Mexico. As chief of internal security, working with G. Gordon Liddy, he supplied the names of free law-abiding citizens that were to be kidnapped in 1972 and taken across the border. He was convicted January 1, 1975, and charged with cover-up. The U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals threw out the conviction, not because he was innocent, because they said he should have had a separate trial from John Mitchell and Haldeman, but they don't intend to retry him. They didn't say that there was new evidence that he was innocent. It was just that he shouldn't have been tried with the other three Therefore, we're dropping the charges, no more retrying of Robert Mardian, and now his law degree to go before the United States Supreme Court has been reinstated before the Supreme Court bar. Larry O'Brien wrote a book called No Final Victories. He worked for Howard Hughes. He was chairman of the Democratic Party. His role was very mysterious in the Watergate because he worked for Howard Hughes before and after, and probably all of the time. And it was his telephone that was allegedly being tapped, although the motives were much bigger than just listening to what Larry O'Brien had to say. But he dropped his lawsuit. It wasn't very much. He got his book publisher. No Final Victories. Alex Butterfield, the man who was able to slip Richard Nixon out of office, which is what Frank Sturgis is intimating and what Nixon is intimating, is now vice president of the International Air Service Company, a California-based concern that leases flight crew and air charter services, and they have air sales and management. He's the vice president of the air company. The third prosecutor of the Watergate case, in addition to Mr. Glaser and Peterson, was Earl Silbert. And when he was taken out of the investigation of this and a special prosecutor was brought in, he wasn't kicked in the pants and thrown out. He was appointed to the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, a very big position in the District of Columbia. Robert Vesco is secure now. He's been charged with a $200,000 illegal contribution to Richard Nixon's campaign. As of this June, next month, he will be eligible to become a Costa Rican citizen. And the United States government never once bothered to ask for his return in all this time. Frank Turkheimer was the chief prosecutor of former Treasury Secretary John Conley in the 1975 bribery trial. And he was nominated by none other than President Carter to be a U.S. attorney for the Western District of Wisconsin. This is a promotion. He headed a team of lawyers from the Watergate Special Prosecution Force and gave a weak trial, a weak prosecution that assured John Conley's innocence. And now he's going on as an appointment by Jimmy Carter. John Conley was supporting Jimmy Carter, and now the weak prosecutor has been given a nice appointment in the Western District of Wisconsin. Incidentally, Leon Jaworski, the special prosecutor of the Watergate, is now lined up with Bryce Harlow to sabotage the Consumer Protection Agency, which represents a lot of our interests in this country, and he's back with his mischief against the Consumer Protective Agency. Another person who's active, was never arrested or mentioned, who was so important to cover up at the time of the Watergate funding, was a man that lives down in Texas, Houston, Texas, and his name is Mr. Allen. His job is to Robert Allen. He works for Gulf Resources, a chemical corporation, and it was that office that first had the money that was sent from Mexico through the Gulf Resources up to the Watergate, the offices in Washington, D.C., of Maurice Stans, and then down to Miami Bank of the Cubans down there, and then back in their pockets, the Watergate Hotel. The Watergate investigations never touched the Gulf Resources and Chemical Corporation, and is a very big organization. This Mr. Allen also owns a sulfur corporation and several other programs that might interest you, and one of them is the Lithium Corporation of America in North Carolina and the Great Salt Lake Mineral and Chemical of Ogden, Utah. Along with Gulf Resources, he has the Lithium Corporation, and I'm sure you'll sleep better at night when I tell you what the Lithium Corporation is. It's the world's leading producer of lithium, which wouldn't mean much to you. I'm reading from the Houston Post, because the demand for lithium is so small. But lithium carbonate is the prescription tranquilizer for manic depressives. It attracts a lot of attention because 100 pounds of lithium fills a tremendous amount of prescriptions. I don't sleep any better at night knowing the source of the illegal Watergate money that could go into these assassinations and murders and the cover-ups or the plans for riot and be washed through his offices is not only involved in oil and chemicals, but makes the unusual chemical for our mental hospitals, our mental patients, their tranquilizers for the manic depressives that this same man's company, the Lithium Corporation, is making your tranquilizers. Another payoff was Carl Feldbaum, the former assistant Watergate special prosecutor, and he was named to just recently the Defense Department as the Inspector General's post. He's been promoted to the U.S. Defense Department, and it was the Defense Department that was working to get Richard Nixon out because of his stand towards opening up Entente with Russia and China, and a far further right-wing group was sabotaging Richard Nixon, and one member of the special prosecutor's team has now been named to the Defense Inspector General's post in Washington, D.C. Another young gentleman by the name of Roger Stone, who had the alias of Jason Rainier during the Watergate Dirty Tricks, is now organizing with Mr. Ugary in Washington, D.C. and in the Southwest a plan to make the entire Congress a far-right Republican by the next elections, if possible. And this is very important because of the sabotage against members in Congress that have been infiltrated by the Korean CIA, and the scandal will just break at the time of the next elections. This gentleman was cited by the Watergate Committee for sabotage and espionage and never charged for any crimes. He now is very active in Young Americans for Freedom, which sponsored Spiro Agnew in the first place. Even though Agnew is out of office and not running now, he says he could run again. He said that last week. He could win and he could run again. And the same people that were behind him at the time of Watergate are working harder now. It was the same Roger Stone that hired a Michael McNenaway, who was sedan chair number two at the time of Watergate. And he was paid $5,000 by Charles Colson to send money to Pete McCloskey and say it was from the Gay Liberation Front, and some more money from the Trotskyite Young Socialist. And then they drafted anonymous letters to the Manchester, New Hampshire newspaper, to William Loeb, and said that McCloskey was getting money from Trotsky Foundation, the Trotsky contribution. This man is active in the Republican Party. He's spearheading the Youth for Republicans. He isn't discredited, and he's believable. And he's working night and day for plans to work and infiltrate the next elections. Well, those are a few of the lovely people that have been promoted with books and money and millions of dollars and lectures, and they get speeches at the college campuses. And yet, every person involved in the Watergate is hiding still this valuable information. Next week, I'll do a little bit more on the Nixon tapes and what they mean. And until then, listen to David Frost and Richard Nixon, and listen for keywords that Nixon has given us. I'll see you next week on Dialogue History.